Welcome to the Unusual Creatures Podcast, a podcast about the unusual creatures that fall in love, stay, stray, come back, and sometimes leave this insane business of artistry and show.
Against all odds, our guests have persevered and told stories using their mediums of choice. Now, these are their stories. And our stories.
The incredible people who you might know by sight, whose names you may not recognize, whose work you've definitely experienced or will one day experience.
Art is a ripple effect, and these artists' creativity makes a lasting impact. Let's hear more. Good morning, good evening, good night, ladies, gentlemen, non-binary humans. My name is Jenny Gomez, and I'm joined today by...
Hi, I'm Kim Berrios-Lynn.
What's up, Kim? You might recognize Kim from episode 22 of season one. We are kicking off the Unusual Creatures season two by doing something a little different. Some of the feedback we got from the audience is that people wanted to get to know myself and Thomas a little bit better, but then also wanted to hear from some of the audience's favorite guests. And Kim Berrios-Lynn is one of those incredible unusual creatures. Kim, we are going to grill Thomas Dane today, and you and I are going to tag team on interviewing Tom. How are you feeling about all this craziness?
I can't wait. This is going to be so much fun.
Yes. Kim, tell us what the hell you've been up to since episode 22.
Yeah,
it sounds
sure.
Like you have just, you Pretty Little Liars launched. You absolutely crushed it. You're getting all of the affection. Yes.
Thanks. Yeah, it was a whirlwind in the best sort of way. So Pretty Little Liars season one premiered. I did an episode of SVU. I did an episode on FBI. A bunch of little projects in between. And we're now filming season two of Pretty Little Liars. And so, there's... been keeping busy. Just recently did a little project. Chelsea Film Festival was producing it, and my son was on it with me. He's 4 years old.
Oh my God. I can't imagine what it's A, like to work with a 4 year old, and B, your own 4 year old.
Oh my God. Like, he listened to everybody else but me. It was quite incredible. I was like, do I need to have cameras on and a director at my house at all times to get him to brush his teeth?
Uh-oh. Your worst nightmare. You might have a little actor in the making. Oh my God. Too good. Well, Kim, I'm super excited to go. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh my gosh,
and I'm
so
excited to. Yes. Thank you. And I'm super excited, like your star is like shining and you're like in the stratosphere. And it's amazing. Should we talk to Tom and make him very uncomfortable and put him in the hot seat?
Absolutely.
Let's
I'm just
go.
Gonna speak like this.
Yes. Without further ado, let's welcome the hostess with the mostest, Mr. Thomas Dane. Thomas, welcome. You are now in the hot seat.
I like it hot. So that works.
Yes, he does.
Yes, hello. It's the Thomas Dane being interviewed. Hello, world. Hello, everyone. Hello. Happy season two. Happy season two, Jenny.
This is going to be a little weird. Let's see how this goes.
Yeah, hello, Kim. Hello, Kim. Thank you for doing this.
Oh, hi. I'm so happy to. You two are the best.
Shucks. Like, so you got to catch me on a certain day, really. You've only caught me on good days.
We always start out, Thomas Dane, you know how we start out, and I'm going to mispronounce it on purpose with your village and origin story. Thomas Dane, what is your villain origin story?
My villainous story. I'm so glad that just happened organically by accident last year, because now it's like one of our, I would put it on a t-shirt for sure. Oh, my villain origin story.
Merch,
Thomas merch. I'm Thomas Dane, and I was born moons ago before Columbus even sailed the ocean blue. And that's how I feel lately. I began in Queens in Astoria. Shout out to Astoria, Queens. Although I would love to go back there, but it's too expensive. When we left, my mother was paying $330 in rent. I'm just saying. And now, like, the same apartment is like $5,000. But I started out in New York, born to a single mother. I was a wild and crazy kid. So when I had to, my grandmother was very religious. So, of course, I had to go through Catholic school. Shout out to St. Joseph's and Sister Mary Catherine, who hated me, who's dead now. I won. No, seriously, we had like
5 minutes in, like, and he's killing nuns. I mean, Thomas.
What's funny is that we had it out for each other, and I think because she didn't like single mothers. She was like 100 years old. She fell down the stairs. I was nowhere near her, but I was out on a bathroom break, and people were like, did you push her down the stairs? And I was like, absolutely not. And then I was like seven, and people ask if I pushed a nun down the stairs. That's for another podcast. So anyways,
tells you everything about a baby Tom.
It's generally quite stressful. And so, but we started out, one of the good things about the school was that it was an artistic. It had artistic classes and stuff. It wasn't like completely all about Jesus and God. And so there was art classes and dance classes, and every year they would put on like assemblies and stuff, and that's where my love of I didn't even know it was the arts began, because I was like, I remember my first pageant was in kindergarten. We were Cabbage Patch Kids, and the Cabbage Patch Kids were like the jam, man. I had like 10 of them, and so I was like, I want to be a Cabbage Patch Kid. And we had to sing We Are the World, and I remember like it was really cool, because they put us in like holding in like the lunchroom, and they brought us up, because in the whole day of school was for the pageant, so it was like basically, you know, a non-class day. They brought us in, did the countdown, did all the stuff, and then the teacher's like, this is what's gonna happen. I'm sitting there, I'm like, whatever, and had this Cabbage Patch mask on, and which I made myself. And then like she did the countdown, the curtains opened, and honey, my world just changed. I was like, oh, all these people were there and like clapping, and we're singing We Are the World. And I think I was like the one, you know, those videos that are coming out now with those little kids, like that little girl who does Respect. Have you seen her recital, and she's the one swinging her hair and doing everything? That was totally me. I'm like, we are the world, you know, we are the children. And we're supposed to like hold hands, and I like drop everybody's hands, and I'm like, yes, yes, like we are the world, you know. I just craved attention, you know, and I just knew just from the beginning, maybe because I was an only child with a single mother. I don't know. The big realization came in that same school a few years later. Every year, the fifth grade would be like the MCs of the Christmas pageant. Like it was a big deal, the Christmas pageant, because, you know, Jesus. And so we hosted, and I got to open the show. Like I was by chance one day in class, and my teacher, her name was Miss Greco. Shout out. She's crazy, total loon bag, but she was a good teacher. Friends and I were fooling around during break, and I did a Pee Wee Herman impersonation. And she was like, oh my God. She's like, you sound just like him. I'm like, oh, do I? And the other kids were like, yeah. She's like, I have an idea. And I was like, she's like, you're going to open the show as Pee Wee Herman. And I was like, and she went and bought me like the Pee Wee Herman doll and dressed me up like exactly like him. Like I came out to like this thunderous applause. And then did like a little monologue and stuff, welcomed everybody. And then afterwards, it was like, you know, after you leave the stage door, and they're like, oh my God, oh my God. I'm like, oh, this is wonderful. I was like, this is wonderful. But what's funny is that when I reflect on that years later, I remember that being, I was completely calm. Like I had found my home. Mm-hmm. And I like up there, and I didn't realize it until so many years later, because now I've had so many issues in life that now I get nervous. Like when I did my one man show, which we'll get to, like, I mean, I was ready to pull the fire alarm and run out of the building, you know, like,
sure, sure.
I tried to like go back to that moment, you know, that calm of like, oh, I belong here, but I lost it somewhere along the way. But like, so I've always been running to get back to it. But yeah, so that's where the villain emerged. With,
sure,
because of Jesus
and Miss Greco, we love
her. Miss Greco, and thank Greco. You, Miss Greco.
We always talk about teachers on Ms. this Greco. Podcast. Yeah. Yeah, the teachers drove us for sure.
Well, not because yes, you could say you wanted the attention, but you were really good at it, because that was not the experience that every other kid had there. So when you were saying that, I feel like Jenny and I probably had similar experiences, and like that's something that's like the through line for artists, because not everyone can get up in front of a stage and feel elated and feel something. Right. Working through them. So it was just like something clicked in. It's so beautiful. I love that story.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was one of the things that a lot of people had mentioned, and like a few of the kids, because you would think there'd be a lot of jealousy and stuff, but like nobody else wanted to do it.
Right.
And yeah. they were like, oh my God, no, no. Because they were trying to figure, she was trying to figure out an opening, do a little bit of this. And people were like, I don't know. I mean, everybody was fine with like big group numbers. Which, I mean, I was fine with too. I'm a very good ensemble worker. I was like, I don't want anybody out there thinking like this bitch. Yeah, it just, and I'll never forget. It's just like a comp. And I took that early on too, like in my first show down in Florida, which was Come Blow Your Horn. I remember people asked me like, were you nervous? I'm like, no. I was like, I wasn't. I was like, and when we worked together a lot, we really were very nervous, like in the beginning. I don't know how you feel anymore, but like back in our day when Jenny and I started out, I was always like, let's get out there. Let's do it. let's do it. Even when stuff would go wrong, I'm like, and stuff went wrong. Stuff goes wrong.
No, it's true. But, and I think it's such a good, that's such a good point, Kim, like exactly what you say. Like I had almost the same experience when I was growing up. Like my first like school pageant, I was also a little Jesus nerd and I went to a Lutheran school and we had the oh, like Christmas. Right. Yeah. We had the Christmas cantata and I could do, I did a Boca accent and I was supposed to play. Yeah, I had a did. Little tiny role as the innkeeper's wife. And I was able to say, hello, good morning, like very much in like the people of my hometown. And I remember the choir director who was like the director of the Christmas cantata was like, oh, you can do this accent as like a tiny child? Like you're gonna like, and, like wrote the role like out to be like to pop in and just say like comedic relief. Same exact kind of thing. And Kim, yeah. like what was your experience like where you were like,
I mean,
as you just like slipped right into it?
Well, so mine was more with dance, but now that we're in the Jesus theme, I actually had a Jesus moment too.
This happened on your episode. We all keep circling each other.
Them, right? I love that. I played Mary. I played Mary and I walked down. I felt like I was like walking down a red carpet when I walked through the pews, through down the aisle. I was like, oh. And I remember my little friend, the sweet girl, she was a little jealous that I played Mary. But I had my first experience with that where I was like, we're all in this together. But better believe I strutted down that church aisle. it just felt right. It clicked in and I was like, I was not nervous and I noticed other people were. And it's Jesus and clicking into our star power, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, there's something to be said too. Like church is nothing if it's not a theatrical pomp and circumstance place.
Oh yeah. All of the drama. Church has all of the drama.
Well, and you, so I know, so this, so it obviously was like with so many of us, it starts at a young age. Like we know pretty soon when it's like easy for us to get in front of an audience, especially if we're performers as our craft and as our creative craft. We can talk about the high school years, but I know you went to film school for college. What was like, what prompted the film school path versus just going straight into performance? Knowing what you had known, well, being this very already. Overdramatic altar boy.
Well, what's funny is like, I will say a big shout out to my mother as a single mother. She did everything I think would be right. She put me into everything. Like she took me to art. I did art camp. She would take me to movies. She would take me to theater when we could afford it. My first show was Cats, like on Christmas Day. And I remember like being like, oh my God, this is like, I was feeling it, but I didn't know what it was yet. Like I'm one of those kids. I didn't realize I wasn't like a born child actor. Like I didn't realize I could do this. Like this could be a thing, you know, because everything I was seeing was adults and it never dawned on me. But she put me into everything, but then she also put me into sports, which was an unmitigated disaster. And the story is about that. Like, I mean, I would play basketball and stop the game. Not in a good way, because like I would stop the game and I would get the ball and I would just run with it because I would like, and then the coach would like hundreds of people and he's like, and like everybody's yelling at me. I'm like, what? I guess it's called traveling. I was like, you're supposed to dribble. And I was like, well, that's just stupid. I'm like, I don't understand. I'm like, I caught the ball. I won.
So specifically the sport you're speaking of in this moment is, I think, basketball. Am I wrong?
Okay. But I treated it like football. So I like knew like sports were not it. But shout out to my mother who threw me into everything. And so when in high school, I'll just touch on high, because I know in my bio I was like, skip it. But I was like, just briefly, because I want to give a shout out to a teacher, was my theater teacher. His name is Mr. Coppola. He like opened my world to acting and what it was, what it meant. Like, I didn't know what a monologue was until ninth grade. And then I was like, I remember giving like a one page, he gave us like all a one page monologue. It was like 2 minutes. And I was like, memorize 2 minutes. What are you kidding? Never, you know, it's like, it's insane. Meanwhile, our brains memorize everything all the time. Like that's how we live through life. We memorize words and, you know, songs. And so what happened was I went through high school and I ended up taking 5 years of drama because my senior year you're allowed extra free classes and I did AP classes, so I was ahead on a lot of stuff and I had like college credit already, so I didn't have to take some, like they didn't even make me take PE again. Like, what do you want to do? I'm like, I'm gonna do another year of drama. So like I did like 2 drama classes in 1 year. Of course I'm an arrogant 17 year old and I'm ahead of everybody because I moved down. So what happened was I moved from New York to Florida, and it was funny because when we moved to Florida I went into middle school, which in New York really isn't a thing. at least I'm not sure, at least where I was from, like there weren't, there was like elementary was K through eight and then you went into high school. So this sixth, seventh, eighth in middle made no sense. But so I went into middle school and then into high school and I was thinking of I was ahead actually grade wise and I was ahead age wise because they start sooner in New York. So I was as arrogant as possible, like working at a movie theater. I was working in a movie theater and at 17 got promoted to assistant manager. Like, and at the time was like the youngest in Regal Cinema's history of their, by now I'm sure somebody has surpassed me in some phenomenon 12-year-old has been running a theater, but I was like at the time like the youngest. I finished, so I was as arrogant as possible, and at 17 I was like, you know what, I've done 5 years of drama, I was Pee Wee Herman and the Cabbage Patch Kid, I'm clearly gifted as an actor basically. Like, you know, like, so I'm gonna go to film school and I'm going to conquer directing. I was like, that was, yeah. And I have, that literally was the stupidest. That was it. I was going to film school instead of pursuing. I do not know why I chose that road, but it was the road I chose.
And you went to the Art Institute, right? For film school?
I did, yeah. And I got a scholarship to go to, that was one of the reasons. I mean, that did help that I did. I was offered a scholarship to the International Fine Arts College in Miami, which has now been merged with the Art Institute of Miami. So I was like, I'm going to go direct. That's what I did. And it didn't take long for me to realize, oh, I fucked up. So I did the first year and it was fine. And I made really, you know, great friends and learned a lot of things. I don't know. The second year, I remember that was when we started getting into real stuff. And the reason I chose the school is because they didn't make you wait to start doing film work. Like a lot of these universities will, the first year or two will be like light film work and getting all of your generals out of the way. Like they were pretty hardcore. Like I had like 7 to 8 classes every semester, like English, math, and film courses. It was grueling. It wasn't easy. But I remember with the second year when we finally started doing films, I'm like supposed to be directing, right? The script that I wrote. And like the DP, like I don't understand cinematography. God bless cinematographers. They are geniuses. I would be like, and you're supposed to be involved in like figuring that out. My DPs, I was like, I don't get it. They're like, we'll take care of it. Don't worry. And then we make up a story later to the teacher of like how like I was part of it. And I was like, and as I'm supposed to be talking to the crew, I'm like looking at the actors, like they look like having so much fun over there. Like I miss that. I want to be over there. Like, and I had written the script, so I wanted to read it. You know what I mean? I wanted to. I was like, and it was like during that second year, I was like, oh no, I fucked up. I chose the wrong path. But that's okay because I did learn a bit about directing and I did learn how important, I think it's important. I think a lot of directors, I've worked with a lot of, and I'm sure you two can attest, like working with a lot of shitty directors because it's some sort of, I'm like, I get you, they're in charge, but this is also a collaborative process. And a lot of them don't know how to collab. So that taught me a lot about what collaboration means. So like, and I went and then just went into Florida, into the world of Florida theater and independently studied because I was like, I want to get back into acting. I miss being, I'm still trying to understand what that was. I feel like I started early, but also am a very late bloomer because I did not fully comprehend everything until much, much later as to what it meant to be an actor. And I did that then when I was doing it independently. And like when I started working in like powerful shows and like had my teacher Dolly Workman and really great directors that I work with independently, that I was like, oh, this storytelling through this way and what it did to me personally is something I learned later after college.
Well, Kim, did you figure it out in college?
No, yeah. And I don't have it figured out now either. I don't think anybody knows what they're doing, really. But like, it does seem like, I know you joke about it, but you were exceptional all through growing up. And then you ended up in this directing program. And often it's like, you're right. Like, we covet those directors who have acting experience. And I've never thought about it the other way around. So here you are, an actor who has directing experience in this like pretty intense program for a year. So do you feel like that helped you as an actor?
It does. And I've been told that I should direct, but I get very defensive because then it's like, I'm an actor. Don't call me that. Because when I realized I could write, I'm the same way. It's like, your writing is great, but also I'm an actor. I'm an actor. I was like, I'm like frantic about reminding people, but like it's helped me a lot in understanding what directors want it's helped me a lot in helping other co-stars in like difficult situations. And so I credit stuff like that when I can be helpful to others, I guess, in that way. Because it's good to know. And it's funny, as an actor, I think too many actors, and this, it was definitely me for far too long. My whole story of life, my theme is tardy. My theme is tardy. Jenny can attest.
I can attest.
Everything. But even as I was getting ready for this, I'm like, and as I'm talking about it now, I'm like, oh, I don't know what it is about me that I feel I'm so behind sometimes. Actors need to realize that acting, if you want to do it as a business and as a life, it's not just about acting. And there's so much more you really, really need to know. And a lot that people aren't going to teach you.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to go to these big universities and these big schools, but they're not going to teach you the business, and they're not going to teach you the difficulty, and they're not going to let you know about, they're going to talk about quote unquote networking. But what it takes to do that, Are they going to give you a course? No. And that's the way, I think that's why knowing as much as you can. So I don't regret taking a directing angle. I wish I had known more of a producing angle. Like that would have been.
And that's like more of the business side. And that's just like project management and like putting the pieces together and like wanting to understand. It's a different brain than the creative brain in a lot of ways. Like, it's about organization and getting to know like craft services to the DP, to the director, to the makeup artist, and like every piece of the pie that makes the art come together as like one unified piece. But that's hard. That takes a very specific kind of person. Whereas like creatives, I find that we tend to just be a little chaotic and messy on purpose. And that's where the good stuff comes out of us. Production is like, you gotta be clipboard in hand, spreadsheet on the screen, ready to go. It's just a different brain.
It almost makes me wish that I had gotten into, I dabbled a bit, but I wish I had really taken seriously speech and debate. That gives you some sort of steel rod and able to, not just to talk to an audience, but just to talk to people, especially people you're going to be in charge of that you're going to need to collaborate with at the same time. It gives you like a calmness about like, I can control this situation. Not completely control, but you know, to be a leader.
And like also to be able to pivot. Like, debate is about being able to pivot. It's about to take an argument and look at it from every side. And that's, again, like, that is not easy. It's improv in a way, but it's also like politicizing the improv, which is like,
that's a great point. I like that. That's merch. There you go.
Yeah, you're forced to articulate your view too, which when I'm in my right brain, I find that hard to do. Sometimes someone, you know, I'll read somebody's script and they're like, what did you think? And I'm like, I can't, I'm not there. Like, I can't, my left brain has not kicked in. Like, I can't analyze this right now. I just love. And like, they're like, that's not helpful to me right now.
You're like, I'm an empath and a chaos monster. And that's what makes me make good art, you know?
Yeah.
Well, no. So you realized that behind the camera was not your vibe. And what happened after? So you left the art
Institute. Well, so then I left.
And then you started doing theater in New York, in Florida.
Florida, with you.
Florida.
And my very first audition, out of deciding I'm going to be an actor, was where we met. She and I met on an audition for this crazy show called something about, what was it? All the Way About Phil? Something
about Phil.
It was
about Phil Oakes, the folk singer. What's crazy, Tom, and I don't think I ever knew this, that was also my first audition in Florida.
Really?
Aww.
Yes.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, aww. That was my first. I was like, I think this is what I'm going to go out for. She got it. I didn't. It was fine. I was not bitter. But that was an experience we'll talk about on your episode. Because that was a show and a half. But
That was a show and a half.
But we met and we bonded and then ended up doing a flurry of things. And I did a lot of great work in Florida. I did some of my best roles and really learned about what it meant. I mean, all I had at that point was like high school and then like directing actors in film school and learning what it meant to actually do this. And then when we got along far enough, we got audacious and opened our own company because we started only because at that time in Florida, too. And Florida's a very different landscape right now, culturally and artistically. It's not where we were at that time. Everything back then was just like revivals of Hello Dolly. Literally like three Hello Dollies would be happening within 50 miles. And you're like, seriously? I'm like, you know, and then like.
Well, because it was all retirees. It was all retirees. And that's what they wanted to see. They wanted to see old Broadway. you know.
Hello, and we Dolly, were like, Neil Simon.
We wanted to do indie theater. Yeah, we wanted to do indie stuff. We wanted to do Nikki Silver.
We did, and we found Nikki Silver. Shout out, Nikki, come on the show. And Raised in Captivity is one of the best ever. And it's a genius play. And like, so it's funny because I was like, I had done this show that really inspired me. There was a turning point for me called Burn This by Lanford Wilson. And the stage manager in that show had gone to acting school, and he gave me this monologue, and it's about this, it's about Sebastian, and it's the Mr. Giggles monologue that I call it. And I was like, I've got to read the show. And I brought it to Jenny and a couple of other friends. And I was like, you guys, we have to do this. And we're like, all right, let's try and do this. Like, we're in our early 20s and do it. Like, you know, and but we did it. We pulled it off and did it in this hole in the wall in Miami that was actually turned out, and we turned a profit and people loved it. And that was an experience and a half that I was like, I think when I did Raise was when I was like, you know what? I started thinking about New York, but then when I did Corpus Christi, I was like, I've got to get out of here and go to New York because I've got to do bigger things, better things, more challenging things. And it was funny because I had stopped being offered auditions. I was just being offered roles. And the weirdest thing about that was like, I kind of feel like then I walk in and I wasn't being challenged by other people. I don't want to say that. I don't want that to be a terrible thing to say. I just was like, I don't want to be the best person in the room. I want to learn from somebody. I want to see what I can do next. I want somebody to be there who knows more than me for sure. And, or collaboratively we do something. Then I was like, I'm going to New York. And Jenny was like, let's go to New York. And then we went to New York, which was like a whole new shit show and a half.
Oh, you both went at the same time?
Yeah.
Yeah. We were like 3 months apart. Yeah. It was like 3 months apart. You went, Tom went in February and I went in June.
No, we visited in February and then I went in the end of May and you went in the end of June.
Yes, that's right. We were weeks apart. We were weeks apart. That's right.
We were going to live together.
We were supposed to be roommates.
Jenny needs to be bougie and had to live on the Upper East Side. And I was willing to live all the way the fuck out in Gravesend. So
I didn't want to travel on the subway. Tom lived in his own apartment in Gravesend at the end of the line in Brooklyn. And I had we paid the same amount, but I had five roommates on the Upper East Side. Six of one, half dozen of the other.
And you lived in the Hobbit's room. No, in John Malkovich, the seven and a half. Remember that movie? The seven and a half. You couldn't stand up in Jenny's bedroom.
I had 5 foot ceilings. I would wake up in the morning, I'd get out of bed, and I'd hit my head on the ceiling every morning.
Oh, New York City.
It wasn't supposed to be a bedroom. It was a loft space, like a storage. New York is crazy. New York is crazy.
I think it was actually built for the original owner's cats to live in.
Cats?
Yes. Correct. The whole room smelled like piss, like cat piss. And Kim, what was your journey? Because you grew up close to New York, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Edison, New Jersey, and then I ended up moving to New York City. Well, first I lived in Florida for a little bit, and then I moved to New York City. I went to school.
That's right, remember?
But I lived in Astoria and the Sunnyside area forever and ever, amen.
And we were almost, we should have been on stage together because you were at the Lake Worth Playhouse and we're down the street.
Right. Lake Worth Playhouse.
I re-listened to your episode the other day because we're using I'm using a quote from you for advertisement for our new season. I was like, I love this episode so much.
It's a good one.
But yeah, so then we landed in New York, and that's when the new drama happened. It was
And in this journey, in so far, we know some of the milestones, right? We've now heard some of the milestones. What are some of the moments in your career that have been the most rewarding?
One was still in Florida. I got to do a show that took us to Amsterdam, and the show was totally insane. But it was a good time. And my parts were, I was very challenged by my parts, and I made some really great friends in that. And it felt so good to be like, oh my God, I'm being taken out of the country. It feels like I've moved forward in some way, you know, and that was great. And then I know there's been a lot of I guess most of mine, I haven't reached levels of so much financial success yet or things where I feel like I should lay out a list of I mean, my name comes up if you type it in, but it's not going to be, which also is like sad to me. Like, as you're like, I'm asking about achievements, I'm like, I don't have any. And I'm like,
oh my God, stop.
I'm like, so many.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I guess just a lot of personal ones. You know, my own show, my own, when I guess, you know, more of my rewarding came in when I started writing. And I became, while we were in New York, you know, I was doing a lot of shows. I did a lot of fucking work in New York. And I came to New York with an agent, with a connection to an agent. And then, Jenny and I auditioned for them together. And I worked for like 5 years nonstop. I was juggling like 2-3 shows at a time. And a job at Outback Steakhouse, and then PJ Clark's, and all this. And it was exhausting, but it was a lot of fun too. I read with extraordinary people, but then like the real rewarding stuff came in when one day, like, a friend of mine who I had worked with, and I, you know what, when I started in New York, I took classes with Austin Pendleton, which I suggest everyone go reach out. And if you're in New York, go to HB Studio and take classes with Austin Pendleton. He also teaches privately. He was a very helpful, I still talk to him now, he's a very helpful mentor to me. People in his class that I got close with who accomplished people that I was very always nervous about. I'm always the person who's like, one of my themes in life is like, I'm the one person not worthy of being in the room, like any room. You know what I mean? Like, no. The three of us could be in a room. Well, that's my struggle. That's my personal struggle. And so when they asked me to join, I was like, you're kidding, right? But it was a writer's group. A writing acting group. I had been asked to write something by this woman who owned a theater. It was called Stage Left. And she was like, I had this idea for something. She's like, write it. And I want to put it up. And we did it. And it was like one of my greatest accomplishments. It was this little one act play called Scrambled, which has been done like a bunch of times. Jenny did a version of it. It always comes back to Jenny. And I did a version of it. Like, we've done it, and it's been like done, you know, several times nationally. And that was like a very big high, because I was like, oh my God, like, I had an idea and it came to fruition. And so that was a big high, and just a lot of like personal, like, oh, Cake was a big deal. A short film called Cake that one of our other revisiting guests, Albert Benyatta, who is like the part of Film Shop, was like, this is director, writers, come up with this film and I think you're good for it. And I went out for it and got it. It's this movie about me and my wife and a sex bot that we buy, specifically an Asian sex bot. And the director, the writer, she's Asian. She made a point of this being, and she played the sex bot. She was like, there's a whole point about a whole fetish thing going on. And this film, I had to get naked. And I was like, doing it in a play was one thing, but like doing it for film was like, this is going to be forever. It was one of the best experiences of my life. And the film itself it's been everywhere. My naked ass has been everywhere. And not just in my personal life. I'm saying everywhere. like all over the world. And like, the movie garnered all these film awards and everything. And that was really a big high, like, I feel really good. Like, I should be doing this. And then the one man show was also a very big deal. I felt like, because that was difficult. That was hard. I pulled through. I look at my list and I don't feel like it's accomplished enough yet.
Okay. So why do you feel that way?
Because maybe I'm back. I'm where I am at my life now, which is not, you know, where the trajectory was meant to be.
Where did you think the trajectory was meant to be?
Well, I thought we'd be sipping martinis on the Mykonos cliffs in Greece, you know, and like, like at noon on a Tuesday, just like, this is wonderful, you know. And
goes back to why we started this podcast. Like, you have stayed with the industry and the business, and Kim, so have you. And I was always the quitter. I went into corporate and sold my soul to the devil, because I wanted health insurance and dental and a 401k.
And who doesn't? Oh my God.
But through all this turmoil and self-doubt, what was it that kept you waking up in the morning and saying, this is the only thing I want to do? And maybe Kim too, you can speak to that as well. Like,
I just wake up with the thought of, one of the things, I guess, having gotten, you know, past there, and not to throw you under the bus or anything, but like, because you're one of many of people that I know who have left, who are like, I don't want to do this. And there's nothing wrong with that. The struggle is real, people. Like, in no matter what line you're going, actor, writer, director, producer, behind the camera, even craft service, you know what I mean? Everybody trying to do this is very, very difficult. The one through line that I find from a lot of you who have said what you just said is that you always come back in some way. It's the dark mistress that you can't leave because it's just like in your DNA. For me, I don't know. I every time I think about it, it gives me a panic attack. Like, oh, I'll try it this way. I'm like, I try this. I don't know. I'm like, I just write off the cuff, like in my journal. And I'm like, this has got to be better than some of the things I'm seeing. I just have to like put it together somehow. Like I keeps coming back to me, and leaving it would just make me feel empty.
Because it is a part of you, right? I think that I myself fall into this trap as well, saying if we're not doing a certain thing, then we are not currently an artist. But what the truth is that we're always an artist no matter what we're doing. Jenny, like when you were in the corporate world, or like, you know, Tom, if you felt like you weren't working at the time, like we're still always artists, even when we're cooking our breakfast, right? And I feel like the trap is when we see other people and we're like, but look at them, they're traveling the world and they're doing this and that. But another thing I just wanted to ask you, Tom, like, I suspect that because clearly you've been in like these incredible spaces with incredible productions and all of these things. But you say like you always feel like you're the least successful in the room. Do you feel like that's driven you? Because I know personally, I feel that way. And then it drives me and it makes me more creative. Like it keeps me on my toes.
Absolutely. In the end, eventually, first I go through like a stage of like, I'm worthless and this is ridiculous. And then, I'm like, then I ask questions and be like, well, how did you do this? And how did you do that? And how did, you know, I get inquisitive about the how, what am I missing? You know, and then I go back to like my work and say, okay, well, let's write something. I used to be more about like, I'm going to audition more. I'm going to like, I read more. I read a lot of plays and scripts. And but because of like health issues the last several years, I have not been auditioning and acting as much. So, but the drive stays in me to be like, okay, I can still do this. If they can do this, I can do this. Because the one thing when you walk in the room, you look at some people and you're like, I'm seeing people being either lazier or being not caring as much because they're just there for like a specific reason to just get ahead. Where I used to think that was a detriment. I feel like I used to want to be, I should have focused on getting ahead more as opposed to focusing on the work more. But really the gift is focusing on the work more. But then being tardy, you know, like, so it does give me a drive to be like, I can do this. I can do this. Because this isn't some sort of magic. Because often you feel like I've missed a magical boat or person that, you know, this person has not visited me yet to tell me how to do this in some way. And to do this in some way being, I'd love to be, you know, on an Oscar stage, or I'd love it. It'd be great. But at this point, I mean, I'd love to just be doing it to sustain my life, because it's what I want to actually do, is like a job and a life. And so when I see people who are doing it as a job and a life, I'm like, all right, I can do this. It's doable because it wasn't handed to them. They worked hard. I can work hard. Because often you feel like it's just handed to people, but it's not. That's the secret, probably, that it's not.
It's not. But hopefully with this, like, you know, with the writer's strike and what this is like, all of the revolution that's to come, it's just that we're not compensated as we should be. So therefore, we're often feeling like we're not, our self-worth isn't there, right?
Right.
Because at so many different levels, we should be paid more. We should be paid for auditions, right? So if that happened from the get, right, then all of us wouldn't have these moments of that, right? Of I should be doing this, I should be doing that, because we wouldn't have to work 10 million jobs in order to sustain the life of an artist, right? Once we're compensated properly, maybe not in our lifetime, but
oh, hopefully, you know, yeah.
If we and are, I think, then it'd be a lot easier.
Well, and I think that goes into a lot of like what we deal with as artists when it comes to that self-worth piece. It's like we have to give so much of our time for free that it makes you feel inherently like your time is not worthwhile, which makes you feel like your person is not worthwhile. And it's like,
and
of course,
work is valuable.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like our singular individual voices are second to literally none, like by default.
Right, right.
But yeah, I know. Yes, please. We all support the WGA strike.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, yes, everybody, if you're an unusual creature, we are all standing firmly behind the WGA and all these writers. And God bless everybody on the picket line. I don't have one near me, otherwise I'd be on one. And it really comes down to it, because what's so crazy is that so many people on the outside will look at all of us and be like, I can't believe you guys want more. You're like picketing for what you like. You're living the dream. But really, like, these producers, these companies have money to give. It's just that they don't want to share. And they wouldn't have it without us.
Snaps.
And it's...
Yeah.
All you have
it's
to do
built
is
into
give
the
no
economy.
One...
It's built into the yeah. economy of the business. And like part of like keeping the thumb on us and making us feel smaller is so that they can keep the economy of the business. I mean, it's bad capitalism. Because if they, God forbid, they paid us for auditions, their profit margins would be very different and the business model would be very different.
People at the heads of the corporations that with all our streaming, have you seen the dollar amounts that they make?
Mm.
You can skim a little bit off the top and pay us plebeians for auditions.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, it's especially the writers. And it's funny because yeah. when I went from acting to writing, I remember I was involved in like putting together a short film with a friend, and he would always encourage me to like learn more, do more, know more, because like the technical stuff scares me. I was a terrible editor in college. Horror. I was like, this, I don't understand. I ended up learning to write. But of course, as great as that is, writers might actually be more poor than actors. I've literally mastered the two things that are the poorest. Like, you're kidding me right now. I'm like, oh my God. Because you've got to get to a certain point where they really realize that they need you. Because there are so many of us, but there aren't a lot of people who are really good at everything. There's just a lot of us who are doing the thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the economies of scale are a little backwards.
You know, I realized through my therapy that self-worth is like the epitome of a life well lived. It's something I've struggled with just all the time. You know, that's why I want to get back to that kid who who's Pee Wee Herman, who just was so calm. Because I didn't have any stakes at that point. And once the world starts to smack you around, you're like, oh God. But to try to keep that understanding is like to walk into a room and just be like, I have self-worth and you're going to give it to me. When they're not going to give it to you, I'm like, well, I'm certainly keeping it. So you're going to have to take it from my cold, dead hand, you know?
And we've seen people like that. I admire people like that who walk into the room with the confidence, right? With the confidence that they should have. And you see that everything does work out for them. And I'm always like, how do I just pretend that I'm them, right? How do I pretend that I'm like really confident? I usually try to just like put my best outfit on when I go onto set or something like that. Just pretend, but inside I'm like, oh my God, I'm not supposed to be here. Like, I'm a fake. You know, I think everyone's uncomfortable. Everyone's fighting it because we're all artists and we're so sensitive. So, I don't know a single artist who's not like who's like, I'm the best at everything. You know, and really feels that way.
When you have the audacity to like show confidence, people automatically like, oh, diva.
Yeah, it depends. We used to have a running like joke with just like wearing high heels when I was in corporate. Like put on your high heels when you have like a the big dick meeting with all like white male corporate executives, just so that when you walk in the room, you make a lot of noise. And like there was this running through line that I had with like a lot of sort of female executives in my industry that was like, all right, put your high heels on for that meeting. That little piece of costume. Just because you walk into the room and you go clack, 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 when you walk in and it creates attention and confidence. Ooh. And you're a little bit higher on your feet and it does that physicality to you. And it's such a weird thing, but it's like just putting on your heels. And that's what it is, because we all feel the imposter syndrome unless you're a fucking sociopath. I think only true like sociopaths walk in a room and really feel no imposter syndrome whatsoever. Like that's cuckoo bananas. If you're an empath in any way, shape, or form, like you're gonna feel like you shouldn't be in the room, even though you deserve every moment.
After this, I'm gonna put my high heels on. I'm gonna go upstairs and I'm gonna walk into the kitchen and go, I think you should do the dishes to my husband.
It's a very powerful costume piece, and it can also be a weapon.
Yeah,
it's like a weapon.
Everything
and
is a performance.
100%. Everything is a performance. You talked about it even too, like, you know, even in the corporate world, you're an artist, and it's like, I remember putting the heels on and it just always felt like a costume. Like it's a costume.
Yeah.
It's like wherever you can find that power in order to just walk into an audition, walk into a meeting with a producer, walk into a meeting with an agent, we're never going to feel like we belong, but we got to put the costume on. We got to put the Cabbage Patch mask on.
That's what they say. So they say like dress like what you want to manifest, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a thing, right? I mean, I walk around in sweatpants all the time, but if I decide to put on actual clothing, it does something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we can walk into our creative spaces that way. It's a good
100%.
Lesson.
100%. No, it's 100%.
100%. I think I get exhausted too, though, by like, I don't want to put on a costume. I just want to go in as me and like show you what, like that's what happened like with the one man show, was that I was overweight at the time. I mean, the show was a success.
Your reviews were love letters.
I mean,
I wish I could have seen it.
I remember reading some of these reviews and being like, who are they talking about? Because that's not me. All right, calm down. You know, and like, and the playwright could not have been more gracious. I mean, I did everything right, but people walked out during intermission because I was too fat.
Ugh.
And so it was like, I've come to, after some therapy, I couldn't control that. I can't control that. That's as easy as saying, like, well, he was too gay, or he was too black, or he was too white, or he was too... You know, if you're going to feel something about me in some way that you don't like, I can't change that, which took me some learning to do. Like, I can't... If I can't change it, that's not my problem. There's still that part of me that's like, but I still want to bend over backwards to make you love me. It's hard. It's hard to, like, still feel that self-worth in that moment. And when you're still, like, doing...
actual feedback that was given? Is that actual feedback?
No one... What the fuck? So no one told me that, but I overheard it. Okay. And I literally, so the dressing room is near the box office. And I literally, during an intermission, heard this couple. They were like, I don't want to watch some fat guy run across. And I was like, so, and they didn't ask for a refund, but they were leaving. And I was like, what? What am I going to do with that? And I still went on and did my second act as best to my ability. It's going to be what it is. You know, there are people. I remember back early in my career, I did Death Trap in Florida, and this one particular theater. Oh, with Jenny and I, we did Cheaters, this place called the Royal Playhouse. And the theater owner, one of the things was that he wanted everybody in the cast to come stand in the lobby and greet everybody as they left. And this one woman went down the line and shaked everybody's hands. And I was getting raves about that at the time. And then this one woman came along until she's like, wonderful, wonderful, came to me. She's like, you look around too much. She's like, your eyes were distracted. I'm so sorry. I was like, I'm so sorry. I just left. And then it was funny because when I was in class with Austin, he had told all of us, he was doing like King Lear or Hamlet or something. And the same thing, they were greeting people. And this one guy thanked so-and-so, thanked so-and-so. It came to him and said, this guy knew King Lear or whatever so well. He's like, you missed this line, blah, 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 blah. Like one line, he's like, you missed it. And he walked and he left. And I was like, wow. People are just.
I mean, some people be crazy, I think, is that. That's what. Even if they're patrons at a theater, it doesn't necessarily mean that they should be there.
It's true. It's true.
It's like they'll just, I mean, you happen to be the target a couple of times, but it would be another actor the next show that they saw. They're probably absolutely. Just, that's what they do.
I mean, like,
I've met those people before.
Totally. It's like working in Florida sometimes was like working brunch every night. It was like a matinee crowd every night. You know what I mean? Like the matinee crowd is different from the Friday night crowd. And that's, I think we've all experienced those audiences. Well, Tom, I have to, you know, we're coming kind of to the end of our time here. And I have to ask.
Yeah, I know. I saw the time. Well, it's always with Kim. It's always a good time with Kim Barris Lynn. The next thing you know, it's 2 hours later. Like, oh, my God. Yeah.
You know, we are coming up here and we want to be cognizant as much as we would not like to be cognizant and keep chit-chatting. I'm going to ask you your favorite question. What is your greatest regret?
If you had caught me a few years ago, it would say being born. But I said I would tell you my truth. I said I'd tell you my truth. But I have come around to embracing my life. You know, I don't regret doing this. And it's funny because I think this podcast has helped me because, like, I was waiting, man, that whole first season. Everybody, I was waiting for somebody to be like, oh man, this is all shit. Cause I was like, yeah. Like, it's all shit. Like, but I don't regret any of this. I don't regret the choices I made in, like, I don't even regret going to film school. I think I learned a lot there. I regret the only regret I was making better choices. And, like, maybe I had a little too much fun in New York. Maybe some nights were a little later than they should have been. Maybe some drinks were a few more than I should have had. Maybe believing more, like believing, thinking that, you know what, I'm not going to do that audition because, like, they're not going to pick me anyway. So who cares? And that's so, like, I think stuff like that, the stuff that everybody would be like, that's sweat. Don't sweat the small stuff. I sweat every stuff. The more I've come into, like, my writing and, like, trying to figure this podcast out and, like, going back into, like, the auditioning, like, when I was doing the one man show, even though that crap happened one night during rehearsal, it was a really rough process. It was like 40 pages, me alone. People, you would think, because I'm like, as a narcissist, people would be like, oh, you'd love that. I'm like, no, not so much. I remember coming home and my director was fantastic, but he was rough. He does not play games, and it was the director I needed because he wasn't cruel. He was just, you know, it was, the work is important to him, which is what you want. And then I was driving home on I-95, just hysterical crying. And I called a friend of mine and she's like, listen, she's like, I don't want you to do this. If you need to hear this, so it gives you some freedom. Like when this is done, when this show is done and the curtain comes down on your final show and you feel like this is no longer giving you joy or happiness and you don't want to do it, it's okay. It's okay. And we're not going to judge you. And people who do can go fuck themselves, because if this is not the path, it's fine. You'll find something else. Life will go on and that's fine. You will move forward. Really analyze. She's like, I think when opening night comes, you're going to be fine. And I did. I sat in that. And when the curtain fell, I was like, oh man, I still really want to do this. You know, I guess my only regret is just like being unfocused. I would tell anybody out there to just be more focused and be careful when you're in places like New York and LA, and don't get stuck in the things you shouldn't get stuck in with the people you shouldn't get stuck in. Just try to be more streamlined. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? I hope it does.
It does. It does. If you're going to commit,
doing it,
commit. Yeah. Commit and commit and commit. But it sounds like your own imposter syndrome maybe got in the way and you're like, well, I'm just going to have fun with it. And then you had too much fun.
Well, yeah, that's the way to hide the whole thing. Because if you're the life of the party, no one ever asks the life of the party if they're upset, you know.
Because they think you're having fun.
And don't get me wrong.
You're just a great actor.
Yeah.
I am.
Yeah. Well.
But by the way, I feel like a lot of that happens. New York City does that to most people, though. Don't be too hard on yourself.
Yeah.
I feel like that's part of everyone's New York City story when you move somewhere to New York City. I did it too. Mm-hmm. Out a little too long, wrong crowds, all of that. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. like you got to get over the hump, and you can survive in New York longer if you're just able to get over that hump. Yeah. Oh, New York. Thomas, it's time for your shameless plug. Tell us what you're doing.
Well, I'm doing a podcast called The Unusual Creatures with Jenny Gomez. And next week I will be the host with Albert Bignara, and we will be grilling Jenny. So that's going to be fabulous. I'm doing that, which I'm very proud of, and focusing very much on my writing.
Where can people find your writing?
I write for The Social Edge. Like, I actually write for a living. I write for The Social Edge, georgedecay.com, and percolately.com. And I also am going to finish this new play that I'm working on and launch a reading in the fall. And I had an audition. Let's hope it goes well. We'll see what happens. And that's kind of it for now. I was like, the rest, you know, I can shameless plug through the rest of the season. So that's good for now, because I can throw out my stuff whenever. So, okay. So that's where I am at this current moment. So
fantastic. And where can people find you on the socials?
Thomas Dane. Thomas Dane on Facebook, Thomas Dane on Instagram, and on Twitter. If you want to hit me up at thomasdane@gmail.com, I'd rather you not. I'd rather you hit the unusual creatures at gmail.com, because I get a lot. I'm already inundated with emails and my personal stuff. But that's where you can find me for now.
Fantastic. Kim, one more shameless plug. Where can people find you on the socials?
You can find me, Kim Berrios Lynn, on Instagram, kimberrioslynn.com. That'll do it.
Fantastic.
And Pretty Little Liars season 2 on the way.
Pretty Little Liars.
Cannot wait. Thomas, this has been enlightening and wonderful. Kim, thank you. Any final thoughts, closing thoughts from you, Kim?
Oh, I'm just so happy you guys contacted me for this. you both got me through the pandemic, so it's really cool to be able to be on here and get to interview you, Tom. This is really cool.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you.
High honor for me.
Oh, well,
you are definitely number one on my list when I get back to New York for some drinks. We're definitely going to face-to-face for sure.
Oh my God. Yes, please.
Yes.
All right. Well, this closes out our inaugural episode of season 2. It's nice to hear a little bit from our host with the most, Thomas Dane. And yes, next week I'm going to be in the hot seat. I wish I had hot wings to eat, because that would be ideal, better than just getting grilled on my personal shit. And Kim, we'll definitely touch back with you and be sure to promote all of your work as well deserved. Keep kicking ass in the second season of Pretty Little Liars. And Tom, I will see you next week.
Yay. See you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Kim.
Thanks so much for listening to The Unusual Creatures. We love telling the stories of these creatives, and we hope you love listening to them.
You know the drill. Subscribe where you love listening to pods. Send links to your friends and tell everyone you know about this show.
and I mean everyone, counting the minutes until we meet again, and
keeping unusual creatures.